Welcome to the Mind Virus Podcast. Today is July 22nd, 2025. I'm Jordan Bruno, and again, I'm podcasting solo. Bobby the Flood is recreating. And so I'm going to go ahead and take a shot at another podcast by myself here today. I think the listeners have, well, some of the listeners have expressed that they like these cosmos-oriented podcasts, and so I'm going to go ahead and continue the theme this week, and next week I'll be podcasting solo, and so I think I'll continue with that theme next week also. Well, it's Tuesday. I am podcasting a day late, and it's probably a good thing because I would have missed this story. I want to go ahead and start off with a little bit of commentary on current events like I did last week, hopefully not 20 minutes, but this is really important relating to the main news of the day. Washington, D.C., in a blow to hopes from conservatives that the former president would face severe consequences for allegedly overseeing an attempt to delegitimize the Trump presidency, Barack Obama argued that he can't be charged with treason because he wasn't born in America and isn't a legitimate American citizen. Republicans acknowledged that they could be left without any legal recourse after President Obama absolved himself of any potential treason charge by reminding everyone that he couldn't face any consequences since he was never a citizen to begin with. Quote, "I can't commit treason against America if I was never in America. Never an American," Obama said, confidently, in a brief statement to reporters. "The Republicans have been cooking up wild schemes for years to try to hold me accountable for crimes against the United States. Unfortunately, as someone who was not born in America, I cannot be held to that standard. Nice try, but it won't work. Back to the drawing board," he says. Constitutional scholars agreed that Obama's defense was airtight. Quote, "It's an open and shut case," one expert said. "You can't hold someone accountable for betraying their allegiance to a country if they never had any allegiance to that country in the first place. It's a pretty genius move by President Obama here, almost as genius as falsifying his birth certificate to get illegitimately elected president." At publishing time, Obama and his legal counsel clarified that any and all illegal activity and wrongdoing committed during his presidency was exempt from legal penalty due to the fact that he was never legally president in the first place. This of course is the bee, but not the bee. It is not satire, except that it is satire. Headline: Obama argues he can't be charged with treason since he wasn't born in America. Well, continuing the conversation from last week, as you know, my personal opinion is that the Trump administration, whoever they are, regardless of who's sincere, who's not sincere, they lost the script. They lost the people that put them into office. They've lost all that support by trying to whitewash the Epstein thing. And the news that's come out in the last week has been, in my opinion, an attempt at distraction that the Department of Justice is somehow going to go after Barack Obama and the Russiagate conspirators. And I think I might have said it on the podcast before. I don't think there's ever going to be anything that happens with the Epstein files. I thought that the Epstein files and the JFK files and stuff like that would be a good measuring stick, benchmark to demonstrate how sincere the administration is or how effective they are actually going to be in bringing about change and ending corruption in government. And I think that if I remember right, I pondered aloud or I don't know if it was an official prediction, but I've said it to friends that I didn't think that they would ever see the light of day, the Epstein files. I didn't think that that would ever come out and that this administration wouldn't go as far as everybody wants them to go. And I'm quite surprised at the response of some of my friends, conservative friends that are buying into this Russiagate conspiracy distraction. I think I've lost confidence here. I was trying to be open-minded and optimistic about the administration and their sincerity, but either there's only three possibilities in my mind right now. Number one, they're totally insincere. It's a total Trojan horse. Number two, they're either being blackmailed, or number three, they're being threatened. Their families and their personal safety and maybe the nation's being held hostage. I don't know, but I think it was pretty obvious that not only did Trump but other elements of the organization promise that they were going to release the Epstein files, promise that they were going to keep us out of war, but they obviously have folded to Israel, bombed Iran. They're sending more money over to Ukraine, fighting with the good conservatives in Congress and promoting the bad, you know, the rhinos. There's a lot of good things that have happened, but we can't just give up on reality and on legitimate movement towards positive government at this point. I don't think the base is going to give up on it. And I was talking to my brother the other day. He gave me some good advice. He says, look, we've got to congratulate them on the good things and still hold their feet to the fire. So his response to the whole Russiagate thing was great. That's great. You go after Barack Obama, go after the Biden administration, go after all of them. Now, where are the Epstein files? Now, why are we still funding Ukraine? Now, stop bombing people in the Middle East. Oh, that's great. That's awesome. We're stopping illegal immigration. We're cutting it way back. Okay, now where are the Epstein files? Stay strong on your promise to keep us out of war in Ukraine. Make peace with Russia. Get NATO in line. Get all the neocon war hawks to let's go after them, you know. And let's stop listening to the Israeli lobby, what Israel is doing right now is unconscionable. War crimes, genocide. I don't care who started it. It's entirely disproportionate, and they're just wiping the Gazans off the map. I mean, they're just moving him south, putting him in a concentration camp. You would think that the world could hold the Israelis to a higher standard. I'm talking about the Israelis as the nation of Israel, those that scream and throw a tantrum over the Holocaust every time they get their feelings hurt. Weren't they the ones that should be the most sensitive to the idea of genocide and putting people into concentration camps? We can't turn around and let them get away with it just because they're calling it humanitarian. And just because of the stand down on October 7th last year. So there's my thoughts on the current situation. You know, Martin Armstrong gave a pretty good interview. I guess I'm going to have to link to it, to Greg Hunter. And recently, this was put up just the other day. He's saying that the chance for nuclear war is basically 100% at this point because the wheels are in motion. The non-public, you know, top-tier leaders in government in the United States and in NATO countries are all preparing for war, preparing for draft. They're all just getting their ducks in a row and openly threatening Russia. He says you don't, when you've got a tier one adversary that's the same level as you, right? You don't threaten them openly like Trump has been doing, you know, giving them ultimatums, deadlines, because you paint them into a corner relative to their public perception and their propaganda mechanisms, their relationship with their people. You know, you leave them no room. It's like calling for unconditional surrender like the Allies did to Germany and Japan in World War II. What that did was made certain that hundreds of thousands more people had to die rather than negotiating peace. And one thing you can never do is have your sincere leaders talk to the enemy. You have to cut off all ties and say things like, yeah, they don't want to negotiate. You know, it's like, did you call him? Did you talk to him? No. So interesting discussion from Martin Armstrong. At this point, I'm looking at most of the news that's coming out as a massive distraction. This stablecoin, all wars are bankers' wars at this point. And this stablecoin stuff looks like an attempt to further prop up the U.S. Treasury market, because some of the traditional buyers are like China have stopped purchasing U.S. Treasuries. They need to continue to fund this machine. And so what they'll do is require all the stablecoin issuers to back that with U.S. Treasuries and then sell the stablecoins around the world, because the U.S. dollar has been since, in the last century, it's been the most stable game in town as far as currencies go. And people know that. I mean, it's a good product. That's what it is. It's monopoly capitalism. And the dollar is the product. So they're going to get that out there. That's the underlying thing. Okay, it's the bankers, the financial elements of our economy. Those guys are the ones in control. Watch the money. Catherine Austin Fitz has a great handle on that. Her program with John Titus is very, very, very informative. You want to know where the decisions are made. Start looking at the financial elements in this equation. Okay, I said I wasn't going to go on for 20 minutes ranting about this. I'm going to stop. There's a lot to be said. If I wanted to take more time, put together sources and more coherent statements, I'm sure I could make a better argument for what I just said, but I think you get the point. You guys can see it all around you. But I'll link to some of those sources on the podcast page. We like to put up references, you know, do a little bit extra for the listeners of the podcast at our website, which you can find at https://www.mindvirus.show. You can leave us a comment there. Please don't comment on Spotify, Real TBM. If you are listening, if you really are the Real TBM, not the old TBM from The Ohio State University, or anyone else that wants to comment on Spotify, please don't, because we won't see it for 6 months. Please comment at our website at mindvirus.show, and that way we can respond to your comments in a timely manner, or not, or choose to completely not respond to them. Just know that they're never disregarded. Bobby and I read all the comments. Speaking of comments,
your muscles have atrophied. We're rebuilding them.
Why my eyes, sir?
You've never used them before. Rest, Neo. The answers are coming.
Why do my eyes hurt? Okay, so that was for Publius. Now, I'm kind of half joking. I know, Publius, if you're listening, you are obviously a very intelligent person. You asked the question or made the comment this last time that we need a fully fledged out cosmology book and or video with an exhaustive list of sources. I got to be careful how I respond to that. Anyway, I infer a little from your comments that this some of the material might be not necessarily hard to accept, but different enough or contradictory enough or unusual enough that it's like, okay, I want to chew on this, and it doesn't quite match up with everything I'm thinking, but maybe I'm willing to give it a try. I think that might be where that's coming from. Maybe not. Feel free to elaborate on the website. But I too like sources and everything. I wanna see it proved out on paper in theory, kind of in an academic or a strategic visualization type of a sense. But let's chew on here for a minute another really important idea that also comes from that same movie.
Unfortunately, no one can be told what the Matrix is. You have to see it for yourself.
If you remember the movie, that's right where Morpheus pulls out the blue pill and the red pill. He pops the top on a little Altoids box or something, a little tin, and pulls out the red and the blue pill, and he says to Neo, "This is your last chance." That's not what I'm saying here, but I think it's kind of fun. Now, for the sensors and controllers, I want to remind you that I'm using these clips under the fair use portion of the copyright law. This is all fair use. If I get a little Spotify notification, if you guys are listening to this, I will obviously defend it and say that I have the right to use these under fair use, but I'm just pointing that out in case somebody's listening to it so that you can preemptively allow the content if your AI flags it, whatever that is. And I guess at this point, I'll just preemptively say that I reserve the right to use any media out there under that fair use portion of the copyright law. So I may not follow up every clip with that from this point on, but for some reason I feel obligated to, because I have been notified by Spotify in the past that they didn't like our usage of some of the material that we have fairly used in our podcast just for educational purposes. And of course, any use of this content is more likely to cause our listeners to go out and consume the content through the traditional means. So what I thought we would do today, I think, Publius, you've got a great point. You know, it'd be really great if we had a fully fledged out cosmology book and or video with exhaustive sources. Somebody ought to do that. There are existing books and videos and things that are very helpful. My experience, though, has been the problem that most people think they know what they're talking about. They don't fully acknowledge that they really need to unlearn what they have learned. I guess at this point, I'm obligated to throw in the clip from Empire Strikes Back where Luke tries to raise the X-Wing out of the swamp.
No. We'll never get it out now.
So certain are you? Always with you, it cannot be done. Do you nothing that I say?
Master, moving stones around is one thing. This is totally different.
No different. Only different in your mind. You must unlearn what you have learned.
All right, I'll give it a try.
No. Try not. Do. Or do not. There is no try.
Well, and that's the hard part, isn't it? Unlearning what we've learned. I don't know if you've had this experience. I know that I have. I had an experience. It was back in around 2009. And it was a very spiritual experience. I didn't understand it at the time, but I was kind of discombobulated mentally over the financial crisis. I thought I'd understood the world, and I was a young executive entrepreneur, you know, trying to figure out how to make a ton of money. And when the markets crashed, I realized that I could have lost the money. I saw that many of my friends and neighbors were in dire straits. They had overextended. They'd gotten into real estate, and the whole situation, the bubble, burst, and it exploded all over them and destroyed financially a lot of their lives. And so that hit me pretty hard because I thought, you know, that I, the world was passing me by, and I had talked to my dad about getting invested in real estate, and he gave me a copy of the Kiplinger newsletter, which was a financial newsletter back in the day, may still be, I don't know. They were talking about the potential for a recession, and he, being older, had seen the business cycle before, and of course, was suspicious of what was going on in the financial markets and in the real estate market. And so that kept me from making really poor financial decisions at the time, getting overextended, you know, buying real estate at the top of the market, whatever, for speculative purposes. And so I thought, oh, wow, you know, but for the grace of God, I would have, for the help of my father or whoever it was that kept me out of it, I would have really gotten into trouble there as a young adult, a young professional. Could have hurt pretty bad. And so as I was looking at that, at the world differently at that point, I realized there were people that had anticipated the problem, and I probably ought to start looking beyond the traditional sources that I had previously been consuming for news and information and understanding of how our financial and political system worked. What really hit me hard was when the public was so adamantly opposed to bailing out the big banks, but the government went ahead and did it anyway. They were too big to fail, and it just seemed so incredibly un-American and unjust that the bad actors would get bailed out, and the little guys just kind of had to deal with it. So I started looking into things at that point in my life, and I looked into the history of money, a better understanding of the American political system and the underpinnings of it. And I looked into a lot of conspiracy theory, particularly the 9/11 disaster in 2001. And anyway, long story short, as I was going through that process and I was relearning, you know, unlearning what I had learned and relearning new things, I still was keeping, this particular event in my life was unusual at the time, but I've noticed that I continue to go through this cycle. So there, you try to fill in with better information, but you always have to recognize that there could be better truth, greater truth, better understanding, more clarity available to you if you're willing to let go of the deeply held beliefs that are holding you back, keeping you from acquiring that new knowledge, that new understanding. There's a term for this, and it's stymied. It's a golf term. You can't putt if something's in the way of your ball on the green. You have to, this is why these golfers will routinely put down like a little penny or a button or whatever on the green in place of their ball, because they got to get the ball out of the way so that the other guys can putt or can see the green. You can't, if you've got something in the way, you're stymied. You probably have also seen or read about a more Eastern saying or proverb that a cup that is already full cannot be filled. You cannot fill a vessel that is already full. I've seen, I think this was in the movie 2012. I can't remember, but I remember visually seeing a Buddhist monk pouring tea into a cup that already had tea in it, and of course it overflows. You can only hold the tea that there's room for in your cup. So if you've already got stuff in the cup, you're stymied. You can't fill in the blanks. So anyway, this quest for knowledge, this quest for higher knowledge is really important. And I bring up the unlearn what you have learned because that's important to consider. I don't know what the situation is of every person listening to the podcast. I know some of you personally, and we've studied a lot together, and that's interesting because that's, you know, that's unusual. Publius, you haven't been privy to any of that. You're new to the crowd, and of course this is tough because we have a stage names, and we're trying to protect the innocents on the podcast here. But you know, I'm not sure exactly where you're at, but your comment about writing the definitive book and putting all the sources out there is an interesting comment. But it also needs to be taken in the context of the Matrix material, in that it is difficult to acquire this new knowledge. It hurts. Our muscles have atrophied. Our eyes have never been used. And you cannot be told what the Matrix is, unfortunately. You have to see it for yourself. On the flip side of that, there is a lot of stuff we can talk about. And so what I wanted to point out, I was telling a little bit about my experience, and I'll wrap that up. I was studying one of these topics that I didn't want to believe. I didn't want to unlearn and switch to the opposing point of view or a different point of view. There's generally more than just one opposing view, or there are two sides to a story. There's usually a lot of sides to a story, and that's really important to remember when we're going through this process, because the truth is out there, to quote the X-Files. But as I was going through that process, I remember watching a documentary, and at the end of it, saying to myself, "Wow, that was compelling. I think that's probably accurate. You know, it was something I really didn't want to shift my opinion on." And I was having a conversation with God in my head. I didn't understand that at the time, but the voice basically said, "Well, what do you think?" And I said, "Well, it's almost irrefutable. It's got to be true, you know." And it's like, "Well, do you really believe that?" And I'm sitting there, I'm about to say yes, and it's like, hold on a second here. Do you understand the implications? There's going to be consequences if you shift on this one, you know? And I think in my mind, and this is all happening in a split second, I think in my mind, I addressed that, and I said, well, no, you're right. But I'm more interested in truth, and I'll take the consequences. And so, yes, I believe I'm switching my opinion on this. I'm switching what I think. And in that moment, when I did that, then I had this rush of what I can only describe as spirit and intelligence fill me. And I realized in that moment, the most important takeaway was that everything I had ever learned could possibly be wrong, and I needed to reassess all of it. Now, last week, I kind of went through a little bit of that process, at least my way of thinking with you, when I touched on the whole idea that the LDS Mormons have become very dogmatic about the point that we came here to get a body, a physical body, because God has a body, and we need a physical body, and that's why you're here, is to get the body and then become like Him. Now, as my exploration has ranged all over the map, high and low, and through all kinds of sources, I've come to realize that that is quite a childish or immature view of the cosmic material and the scriptures, the idea that you're here just to get this body, especially in light of some of the things that Joseph Smith has said. He said that, you know, we need to walk the path that all the gods have before us, and go from a small degree to a great degree, from grace to grace, from exaltation to exaltation, until we can sit down and dwell with those who dwell in everlasting burnings. The reason they dwell in everlasting burnings is because they have bodies of burnings. They literally are, like Paul said, a consuming fire. They are on fire, or at least from our perspective, they appear to be on fire. They are the gods of light and life, are perpetually exuding energy and life force. This is not something that I'm really qualified to talk about, but I bring this up because this is a concept that stymies those who have fully accepted the correlated LDS materials, which is a lot of the people on this podcast. I would assume that at this point, if you're still listening to me, it's because you're interested in what I would call Joseph Smithian theology, or material that has some relationship to the modern LDS church and teachings that didn't necessarily originate with Joseph Smith, but were made popular in America, were given footing in America by Joseph Smith and the Mormon movement. And so that's probably why you're here. Or we could get into the Matrix and say, let me tell you why you're here. You're here because you know something. What you know, you can't explain. It's there like a splinter in your mind, you know? It's that movie is so quotable in so many ways when we are discussing cosmic truths. And so, unfortunately, you can't be told what it is. You have to see it for yourself. But there have been teachers, sent ones, to use Hugh Nibley's parlance, that have brought to us greater light and knowledge that we can consider. Because, and I talked about this in podcast 92, and I've talked about it last week, that's what faith is. There's an unfortunate hang-up in our modern LDS culture, coming from one of the primary songs, and that's the faith song. Faith is like a little seed. If planted, it will grow. That's an allusion to Alma chapter 32. And unfortunately, the author of those lyrics, and I'm not trying to, I'm sure it's a very nice lady that wrote those lyrics. I don't want to be rude or anything, but that's not what Alma chapter 32 says. If you read Alma chapter 32, Alma tells the people, my word is like the seed. Plant my word like the seed. The word of the sent one, the one who has seen. This is the essence of lecture two of lectures on faith. Joseph and his associates who wrote the lectures on faith went through a lengthy exposition on which of the patriarchs knew each other and who knew who learned from who, how long they had lived. The point was that Adam had been instructed and he knew God and he knew the truth about the cosmos and the system and the fall and everything that was going on, to the extent that a man on earth could know in mortality, because we're blinded by our mortality. We can't know everything here in this world. We have to transcend it to get that knowledge. He had that, and he passes it on to his sons and daughters and those patriarchs that would come after him, in the form of faith, teachings of correct belief. Faith is, as Paul says, both the hypostasis and the elenchos. It is the actual reality, the substance of things hoped for, and the evidence of things not seen, the elenchos. It's an evidentiary process. It is the means of finding out the unseen reality. So that comes from the sent ones because they've seen it. They, like Joseph said, to know about God, you got to have somebody tell you about it. You have to have an inkling that he exists and have an inkling of the character, perfections, and attributes of God or the gods or the cosmos in order to find them out. And you receive no witness, meaning you don't get the knowledge until after the trial of your faith. Now, I don't think I need to go source all of those because that's readily available in the scriptures. Ether chapter 12 and Hebrews 11 are probably the definitive sources on that, along with Alma chapter 32. And there I've sourced it. So this is very, very significant for us to consider, for everyone to consider, if you're interested in cosmic understanding or what I'd call higher knowledge or hidden knowledge or esoteric thought. At the end of section 76 of the Doctrine and Covenants, this statement is made starting in verse 113. This is the end of the vision which we saw, which we were commanded to write while we were yet in the Spirit. But great and marvelous are the works of the Lord and the mysteries of his kingdom. He's the kingdom. We're talking about the living world, the celestial kingdom, and the system, the heavens and earths that are created for the progression of mankind, which he showed unto us, which surpass all understanding in glory, in might, and in dominion, which he commanded us we should not write while we were yet in the Spirit, and are not lawful for man to utter, neither is man capable to make them known, for they are only to be seen and understood by the power of the Holy Spirit, which God bestows on those who love him and purify themselves before him, to whom he grants this privilege of seeing and knowing for themselves, so that through the power and manifestation of the Spirit, while in the flesh, they may be able to bear his presence in the world of glory. And to God and the Lamb be glory and honor and dominion forever and ever. Amen. So I read you that statement out of the Doctrine and Covenants. Again, we talked about Section 76 and Dante extensively last week. I read that to you because it's important to remember that God reveals the truth to those who know and love him. He is the one that provides the witness in answer to the faith, the trial of the faith. And it's so great and marvelous that it's not to be uttered, neither can it be, right? It's not lawful, and it can't, and man's not capable of it anyway. So you have to be shown these things. Unfortunately, I can't tell you what the Matrix is. You have to be shown it, and it's sort of immaterial whether. I mean, somebody out there is saying, well, have you seen it? And I'm not going to claim to have seen it on this podcast. Whether I've seen it or been given information about it from the heavens or not is sort of immaterial. The question is, does this taste good to you? Do you want to follow this thread and begin to understand more about it? Is there something resonant here that is causing you to come back to the conversation where Jordan Bruno is discussing the cosmos? And I think the reason that people come back and listen to this and like this is because it is resonant. It does taste good. And even though I'm not getting really heavy on the sources, I'm trying to tie together a lot of concepts that are important. And, you know, I don't think it's something that can be academically proven, and I don't think that's what Publius is asking for here, that we get a book with all these great sources. I think that the sources are important because it gives you more to chew on, more to think about, and it's through the contemplation that the mind is able to escape and transcend. The spirit is able to escape and transcend, or be given a hand out, because they're looking for the handout from the otherworldly sent ones. Joseph's words here are relevant. The things of God are of deep import, and time and experience and careful and ponderous and solemn thoughts can only find them out. Thy mind, O man, if thou wilt lead a soul unto salvation, must stretch as high as the utmost heavens and search into and contemplate the darkest abyss and the broad expanse of eternity. Thou must commune with God. And he goes on and he kind of adds on to it. He said, how much more dignified and noble are the thoughts of God than the vain imaginations of the human heart. Well, there's a lot more to that. You can go read TPJS. You can read Ehat's Words of Joseph Smith. I think it's very fruitful to consider the teachings of Joseph Smith, but we have to remember that most of what we have that's attributed to Joseph came through other people's journals, their recollections of what he said, and their interpretations of what he said, and therefore we have differences of in understanding, as I illustrated about the concept of coming here to get a body, where one of the main tenets of Mormonism, one of the main explanations of why we're here, is entirely based on William Clayton's journal, and William McIntyre had a totally different recollection or recording in his journal of what Joseph actually was trying to say about the body, or whether he was even really saying anything about the body in the first place. So getting back to Publius's comments about an exhaustive source book or source video, What I want to say here is that we should talk a little bit about, for the purposes of this audience and this publication, this podcast, what I want to talk about today is a really important book that is not perfectly clear, but has a lot of information for us. And that is, of course, Hugh Nibley's Temple and Cosmos. It's a perfect place to start in light of what I've just said, because we can talk about how this knowledge has been transmitted traditionally by the Sent Ones to other initiates throughout history. And that is through a dramatic presentation. We call it an endowment. And that comes from the Greek enduo, to be clothed. And it really is significant that this material has generally been taught in such a way that's not strictly academic. It's through allegory. And the reason it's done that, not just allegory, but dramatic allegory, right? Or involving you in the allegory. You must consider yourselves respectively Adam and Eve. You must go to the veil repeatedly. You must go through the process. That involves the learner in the story. And I think that the learner then can learn maybe more than even was ever understood by the priest who put it together or takes them through. The allegory reveals and conceals at the same time. Just symbols can reveal and conceal at the same time. And this putting, it's sort of like a three-dimensional symbol, an allegory. It's got time and space associated with it, especially when it's not just a written allegory. When you're in the setting of the story, then you are receiving your faith teaching probably in the most effective possible way for a person to personally reconnect with what they were before, and the cosmic system from which that is hidden from them in large part. So Temple and Cosmos is a great place to start, because it's all about that whole, it's all about the transmission of esoteric understanding. And of course, Nibley didn't write this from start to finish with the intent to teach all that. He gave these lectures and essays over the course of his professional career, and then they were, I think it was 1992. Yeah, copyright 1992. He was still alive. This is over 10 years before he died. And so I think he had something to do with the assembly of this material, but they put it all into a pretty good order, and then let you go and learn from Hugh Nibley as he this topic is so expansive that he spent his entire career discussing it. This Temple and Cosmos could be looked at sort of as the Rosetta Stone, or the key to a lot of what he taught. It's all about temple knowledge. So it's very appropriate that we have a volume here attributed to Nibley called Temple and Cosmos. Let me just read to you the titles of some of these essays. Number one, The Meaning of the Temple. Return to the Temple. Sacred Vestments. The Expanding Gospel. The Terrible Questions. One Eternal Round. The Hermetic Version. The Genesis of the Written Word. And then he also talks about the Apocrypha and Apocryphal Writings and the Dead Sea Scrolls. I need to interject something also here about Hugh Nibley, my opinion, that he was teaching at a time when it was important to stay close to what the LDS Church's apparent mission was at the time. I think things have changed in the LDS Church. I think that things are... Well, let me just read this from Isaiah. And this is important because things change here on the earth, and they don't always serve the purposes of God. And again, I'm not trying to tell you what to think. This is just where I think it's at right now. Isaiah says, "The earth mourneth and fadeth away." This is chapter 24. the world languisheth and fadeth away. The haughty people of the earth do languish. The earth also is defiled under the inhabitants thereof, because they have transgressed the laws, changed the ordinance, and broken the everlasting covenant. Therefore hath the curse devoured the earth. They dwell therein are desolate. And the inhabitants of the earth are burned and few men left. It sounds apocalyptic, but remember, it also can be metaphorical and applies to our understanding of the living world. We are cursed. We are desolate. We're left in entropy. We are mortal, dying, dead, being separated from the living God. In fact, Helaman chapter 14, verse 15, I believe is the one. Okay, now I got to look that up here in the Book of Mormon. This is Samuel the Lamanite teaching the Nephites, schooling the Nephites, and he says, talking about the death of Christ, he says, he surely must die so that salvation may come. Yea, and remember, not exaltation. This is getting us out of the fallen world, out of the anomalous mutiny world where there's the rebellion going on, which I've talked about extensively last podcast and in 92 and in other places. I did one on Harry Potter and Quidditch and Cosmos. This has come up from time to time. And it's not all organized. Back to Publius's point. It's not organized. This isn't really, it's never been really, I haven't made an attempt to lay it all out. But I think that that's, Hugh Nibley taught the cosmist view the entire time that he was teaching. And it takes a great deal of time and experience. And if we lay it out too plainly, it's like handing someone a gun that's pointed at themselves. You know, we don't want people to just dismiss it all because the cup is already full. You know, when someone's ready, then they go on the quest and they start to piece it together, and then they'll find those publications or presentations that have the extensive truth when they're ready to consume it. So he says, speaking of the death of Christ, this death brings to pass resurrection, the resurgere, the standing up. I'm sorry, I've just started reading verse 16. He says, of Christ, he surely must die so that salvation may come. Yea, it behooveth him that, and it becometh expedient, that he dieth to bring to pass the resurrection, the resurgere, the anastasis, the lifting up out of the fallen world into the living world of the dead, so that thereby men may be brought into the presence of the Lord. See, we're cut off from the presence of the Lord, and that is death. Behold, he says, he's explaining what I'm explaining, and I should just read his words. Yea, behold, this death, the death of Christ, brings to pass the resurrection, which is the lifting up, and redeemeth all mankind from the first death, yea, that spiritual death. For all mankind, by the fall of Adam, being cut off from the presence of the Lord, are considered dead, both as to things temporal and to things spiritual. This gets confusing because we slice and dice it in our correlated lessons and missionary lessons, and we want to say, hey, there's two deaths, and Jesus gives us immortality by overcoming physical death, and then spiritual death is, you know, you don't want that. No, you are spiritually dead already. You're considered dead both temporarily dead. Temporal and temporary are essentially cognates, okay? They're essentially the same. They come from the same root. They mean the same thing. Temporarily. You're temporarily dead, and you're spiritually dead, being cut off from the presence of the Lord. That's what you are here in the dead world. Therefore, we need Christ to redeem us and give us the anastasis, the resurrection, the lifting up out of the fallen world. The body is consequential, but as far as the broad brush strokes go, it's inconsequential, and we get it all mixed up. So the problem has to do with the actual reality. And if these things are taught through dramatic presentations, if you change that, now there's a certain level of, there are differences in varying presentations. Hugh Nibley wrote an entire book on the Joseph Smith papyri and the Egyptian, the Egyptian ceremonies, and demonstrated that they were essentially teaching the same thing. So there's some leeway, but if you break the covenant and change the ordinances, I mean, if you get the narrative wrong, then you no longer have a hypostasis. You no longer have an actual reality being transmitted by sent ones. This is a very important problem that we kind of need to grapple with here. And so trying to work this out is really a positive endeavor in my mind. The problem is that institutionally, people don't like to admit where they've gone wrong. There's no room, like right now with the White House, you can see they don't want to admit that they totally stepped in it. They're going to try everything possible to explain away their comments about the Epstein files and ignore them. And they have to. They can't really openly address it, because the whole point of it is that people are being blackmailed and coerced in government by nefarious entities, nefarious sources, and you know, it's just institutions just have a really hard time coming out and saying, "Hey, we were wrong," because then they lose trust. They lose their purported authority. Trust in this world is a really fickle thing, and the institutions of the world have already gone so far in the wrong direction that if they did admit errors, then they'd lose a lot of support. If we had built upon a solid foundation where we enshrined the ideas that, hey, look, this institution or this group is always focused on truth and willing to change and repent and adjust when we need to, and then we actually demonstrated through our actions that we were willing to back away from things we were wrong on, then we'd have a pattern of institutional metanoia, repentance, and people could trust the institution because they know that when it gets something wrong, it'll try to get it right, instead of consolidating their power, ostracizing people who disagree or who point out truth, who point out corruption, and then just running roughshod over reality. That's just what happens. So if you're listening, you are the resistance. You care about truth, I hope. And I hope that you're listening to what I'm saying with the understanding that I'm imperfect and that you're just trying to glean the next really important thing for yourself, and that you'll, of course, run this by God, and that you're going on the quest for yourself, for you, for your posterity, that you are questing for truth. You're on the grail quest. This is not about a college football rivalry where the referees are always wrong when they make calls against your team. You know, this is about reality, not a bunch of rah-rah. It doesn't matter what any group of people have done in the past. What matters to us is if we can sort it out right now. Okay, I'm already almost an hour into this, and I feel like I haven't really said anything important about the cosmos. So I'm just going to hit a few highlights from Temple and Cosmos here. Just want to show you some things that you can find in Hugh Nibley's writings that are really helpful related to our cosmic quest for truth and for transcendence and for the real world. And, you know, take what you want. I hope that you get something good out of this. Page 14 in the essay, The Meaning of the Temple. Actually, it's page 15. The temple represents the principle of ordering the universe. Now, universe is a word that gets used here, but the better word is cosmos. Of course, cosmos means the thing that was ordered or organized. It can mean the world. It can mean the whole of everything. But ultimately, it comes from the Greek verb kosmeo, meaning to order or to organize. So it is the thing that was ordered or organized. It is the heliocentric point, the sacred center, the heliocentric point around which all things are organized. It's the omphalos, the navel, around which the earth was organized. The temple is a scale model of the universe. Let me read that again more clearly. This temple is a scale model of the cosmos, the thing that was organized. Boxed to the compass, a very important feature of every town in our contemporary civilization, as in the ancient world. Thank you, Professor Nibley. Okay, he's giving us some keys here. This is really significant. The temple is a scale model of the cosmos. And forgive me if I'm not explaining everything in perfect detail. I feel like I did a lot of this in detail in episode 92. But you got to realize, what was organized in the beginning? Was it the temple ceremony goes through a creation drama, a cosmogony, the birth of the cosmos, how things were created and organized. And it's an allegorical manifestation of the thing that was organized using physical, the visible physical elements that we see to describe it. God separated the light from the dark. That's a weird thing to say, because light just either is, and darkness is the absence of light. So is it something that needs to be separated? Not necessarily, unless you're talking about light and dark in terms of good and evil. We see a system of progression set up. It goes from, you know, dry land is created, lights are put into the firmament, creatures of the deep. The movie shows us these crustaceans on the ocean floor, but the deep is in the sky above us. It's the great deep, the heavenly ocean above us, where the cosmic ships of the Egyptians sail into the north. We just don't see this because we're not schooled. No, there's no temple prep. I wish we would have had temple prep with Nibley here. That would have been interesting. This book came out just as I was entering the temple, and I would have never thought to want to read Hugh Nibley, because I thought I already knew everything. So anyway, the creation drama is really instructive if we look at it as an allegorical representation of the system of progression, the thing that the gods initially organized. You get the creatures of the deep. These are the heavenly luminaries. You've got the creation of physicality, which happened right before that. Before that was the separation of light and dark. Before that, at the beginning, you know, the earth is without form and void, and God, the Spirit of God moves upon the waters, and God says, "Let there be light," and there was light. I know I'm kind of going in an odd order here, and I'm not going to go back and fix it. You know, it does actually take some time and effort to not only think about what to talk about, but then actually produce it. So forgive me for the haphazard production value here. I think it's interesting though, because you get this leveling up through the days of creation, and then you get to the plants, then you get to the animals, and then man appears on the scene. And in other ancient narratives, for example, the Epic of Gilgamesh, we see that you have animals, you know, representing mankind, and then in some of the Enochian literature, you have angels are represented as man. So when God puts Adam on the earth, Adam and Eve, he's putting angels or messengers on the earth. And when he's putting the animals, clean and unclean, on the earth, he's putting man on the earth. So we're not... I don't even know if I should even be saying all this. I think this is a fairly limited audience here, but that's the manner of Enochian allegory. That's the style of Enochian allegory, is to have man be represented by animals, and the angels are represented, or the sent ones are represented by men. Why would they do that? I don't know. Think about it. But this does shed all new light on, for example, Noah's Ark. Does it not? Okay, well, the temple is the template. It's the scale model. This is a huge key. Hugh Nibley throws it at us in page 15 of the book. A scale model of this system. Every feature of the temple has some sort of is supposed to have some sort of cosmic significance, be symbolic of this system and of the not only the physical but the spiritual and the metaphysical reality that we are caught up in. Continuing on that page, I'm going to get down to towards the bottom. Because he says, like the Egyptian temple at Dendera, you had to have the Big Dipper there, representing the North Star, around which all things pivot. The main gate must face the east, the sun, the moon, the stars. The 3 degrees are represented there. He just is glossing over all of this incredibly important stuff. It is a scale model of the universe, the cosmos, for teaching purposes and for the purpose of taking our bearings on the universe and in the eternities, both in time and space. And of course, as far as time is concerned, we take our center there. We are in the middle world. And then he gets into a little bit of the work for the dead, which I think is wildly misunderstood. And of course, Hugh Nibley came at a time when it was important to kind of stick within the window, the Overton window of possibilities, so to speak, of what the descendants of Joseph Smith's tradition were willing to accept. So, the purpose of it is that it's a scale model. We go there and we take our bearings on the universe or the cosmos and the eternities, both in time and space. The point is you can go there and figure out where you are at and what you're doing in your eternal progression. Hugh Nibley informs us of some things that are somewhat lacking in our LDS tradition. He says, the temple is the great teaching institution of the human race. This is page 22. Universities are much older than we might ever have expected. A university began as a Greek mousion, a temple of the muses, who represented all departments of knowledge. The Egyptians called it the House of Life. It was an observatory, a great megalithic complex of standing stones, later columns and pylons, with amazingly sophisticated devices for observing and recording the movements of the heavens. A study of Stonehenge shows that it was a computer of great accuracy, a university set in the midst of sacred groves, botanical and geological gardens and groves. It was a paradise, a Garden of Eden, where all life is sacrosanct. It has been said often that the temple is the source of all civilization. A brief statement from a recent article explains that the House of Life in Egypt, where books, which contain some of the earliest poetry, were copied and studied from early times. It was a sort of supergraduate school. It was here in this part of the temple that all questions relating to learned matters were settled. Well, I think I can say definitively that that appears to be lacking in modern temple structure, for lack of a better word. I mean, I have to say, I'm reminded of one time that I was in the celestial room with my mother, and we pulled out the scriptures. She had some things she wanted to discuss, and so I pulled out the scriptures, we started talking, and the sweet old temple worker lady came up and shushed us and told us not to discuss anything in the celestial room. Here's another important thing relating to the temple as a template. In the temple, we are taught, this is page 26, we are taught by symbols and examples, but that it is not the fullness of the gospel. Okay, in the temple, we are taught by symbols and examples, but we're also taught that it is not the fullness of the gospel. One very popular argument today says, look, you say the Book of Mormon contains the fullness of the gospel, but it doesn't contain any of the temple ordinances in it, does it? Ordinances are not the fullness of the gospel. Going to the temple is like entering into a laboratory to confirm what you have already learned in the classroom and from the text. The fullness of the gospel is the understanding of what the plan is about, the knowledge necessary for salvation. You know the whys and the whereofs and the wherefores. For the fullness of the gospel, you go to Nephi, to Alma, to Moroni. Then you'll enter into the lab, but not in total ignorance. The ordinances are mere forms. They do not exalt us. They merely prepare us to be ready in case we ever become eligible. Oh my gosh, I wish that somebody had told me that before I entered the temple. I mean, it's the blueprint. It's not the building. It's not the reality. It's the template. It is a description of the covenant path. It is not the covenant path, to use modern parlance and help demystify something that I think is not apparent to most people attending Sunday school. Well, anyway, I'm sure you love that I'm just jumping around here and throwing little hand grenades out on certain concepts. Page 27, Nibley says it plainly. We know now that there are three worlds, the telestial in which we live, the celestial to which we aspire, and the in-between place, in between them, another world called the terrestrial. It is of neither the celestial nor the telestial. According to the ancients, this world is represented by the temple. It's the in-between world, the nexus point. Here's an important point on page 63 about secrecy. He says, the ordinances are not secret, and yet they are. In fact, I think I'll go ahead and post a link to a place where you can read the temple ceremony. It's ldsendowment.org. I think it's important to be able to go back and review it if you want. Anyway, the ordinances are not secret, and yet they are, so to speak, automatically scrambled for those not authorized to have them. Satan disobeyed orders when he revealed certain secrets to Adam and Eve, not because they were not known and done in other worlds, but because he was not authorized in that time and place to convey them. Likewise, he conveyed certain secrets to Cain, who became Master Mahan, and to Lamech, who achieved the same degree of negative glory. Lamech's wives, in turn, had not compassion and spread the secret things abroad. Moses chapter 5. This is the classical account of the Watchers, angels who came to call the human race to repentance, but who, being tempted by the daughters of men, fell and gave away the covenants and the knowledge they possessed. This was their undoing and was always treated as the most monstrous of crimes, divulging the pure ordinances of heaven to people unworthy to receive them, who then proceeded to exercise them in unrighteousness while proclaiming their own righteousness because they possessed them, he says, on the grounds of possessing them. That's something to think about. Okay, let's move to page 80, the ancient significance of the veil. A study of the earliest Jewish shrines and monuments has pointed out the importance of the veil and its identity with the mantle worn by the high priests. It is at one and the same time the veil that hangs between the worlds, bearing on it the cosmic marks of the compass, the square, the omphalos, or universal center, and the Ibn Shetiyya, or solid earth, on which a man kneels to praise God. These marks are clearly shown in the Astana examples, this is Taoist Buddhist Nestorist veils from the 6th to 7th centuries. It is according to the Talmud at the veil that the information is exchanged between the worlds. For the man who is privileged to have children in this world will through them be worthy to enter according to the Zohar. behind the partition veil in the world to come. And here we go. In the Testament of Levi, the garment of the priesthood refers to the garment of the angel or the personified temple itself. Here, let's go to page 114. The Israelites were either overdressed in fine clothes and all manner of costly apparel, or went about, as the Nephites and Lamanites did in their times of degeneracy, without anything on at all. Both extremes are equally offensive. In either case, it is vulgar. It is a vulgar display of one's person. If you overdress or underdress, you are just showing yourself off, and that distracts from the real purpose of dress. The putting on of the body is compared not only with the putting on of the garment, it is accompanied by an act. A newborn babe receives his swaddling clothes in a ritual, the baptismal garment of the new Christian, which was regarded as an extension of the body, an aura. The garment, the body, the coat of skins. Something to think about there. You're clothed in many different ways, and that lone and dreary world body or garment is replaced or added upon later by other garments, is it not? Robes? Anyway, there's a whole essay here titled Sacred Vestments. Might be worth looking at. Let's move on to the circle and the square. I've got a note here in my copy that says this is a very solid overview. And I think what we're talking about here is why the Ptolemaic model of the cosmos, meaning the Earth-centric or geocentric model, is so important. And that's because it's metaphysically important. We know that the Earth is not the center of the universe, but it's important to us because that's where we are. He says, what exists on the Earth's surface is supported much like a troupe of actors by countless backstage assistants. I've often referred to the Earth as a stage, to which Joseph Smith gave us the scenario. He talked about the stagehands forming a network that extends far beyond the theater walls. The props and the stage are there all along with the stagehands. The big question is there a play? Is there a plot? Is there a meaning to it all? Surprisingly, since ancient times, only Joseph Smith has come up with any kind of a plot. When he faced the world, he had nothing to go on and everything against him. He couldn't lose. He had something concrete to put up while the rest of the world had none. They had the abstract, the moralistic, but nothing in the way of the infinities, of the realities of the next world. Only Brother Joseph had something to offer. Certainly, the Earth is not the center of the universe. This illusion has been discarded forever. Still, this crowded Earth is one of those perhaps innumerable places in the cosmos where both life and consciousness flourish. Many factors united to produce and maintain the right conditions where life was generated by a concentration of mighty forces upon this relatively tiny point. This is the center I am talking about. It is exactly what we read in the Book of Abraham, where he says that everything is relative to the individual. The individual is the center. That's page 140. I guess I'll just finish this off. I guess I'm not going to go very long today. I'm going to finish this off with some comments about the essay One Eternal Round, the Hermetic Version, starting on page 379. This is one of the most important essays that Nibley has ever written, and it addresses the esoteric tradition and how it has existed kind of in tandem with the gospel or traditional Christianity. And he discusses the differences between the esoteric and the exoteric movements and why they're both important. He's getting back to the subject of temple theology, and right at the start, he says, I've been writing for 40 or 50 years on the subject. It begins with a survey of those prehistoric ceremonial centers found throughout the world. The consistency of the pattern by which they're laid out suggests their use as ceremonial centers, and through the years, accumulating data has sharpened the picture, folklore, myth, legend, and custom, along with geometrical sophistication of these centers and their astronomical correspondences, confirm the impression of something great going on long before anyone had heretofore expected it. He says, there are two dominant theories explaining this strange worldwide phenomenon. One is Jung's theory. With primitives, nothing alters except perhaps the language. Religious rites have grown spontaneously out of the basic conditions of human nature, which are never invented and are everywhere the same. The other, which is now generally accepted, is expressed by Lord Raglan. There is nothing natural in the performance of rites. All extant rituals are derived from a single ritual system. Moreover, in all religions, the myths, the doctrines, and the rites form a connected whole, including the death and resurrection of the god, a myth of creation, combat with an adversary, a sacred marriage, and a triumphant procession. So he's comparing and contrasting Raglan and Jung here. Jung, who is asserting that the rites are spontaneous. They just kind of grow up, but they're all the same somehow because they come from the great human consciousness. Raglan said they all come from the same source, and that's why they're the same. He goes on and he says, I summed up the ritual situation thus in an article 38 years ago. At hundreds of holy shrines, each believed to mark the exact center of the universe and represented as the point at which the four quarters of the earth converged, the navel of the earth, one might have seen assembled at the new year, the moment of creation, the beginning, and the ending time, that's the eternal round, vast concourses of people, each thought to represent the entire human race in the presence of all its ancestors and gods. He goes on, and what he's getting at here is that the rites are revealed. He says, the picture was confirmed some years later by Mircea Eliade, the foremost student of comparative religion of our time. Quote, by virtue of these paradigmatic models revealed to men in mythical times, the cosmos and society are periodically regenerated. Note that the man said, revealed. Paradigmatic, I'm having trouble with that word. Paradigmatic models revealed to men in mythical times. It does not seem that any of them, the rites, can be explained, Raglan concludes. There is no accepted theory of its origin or of the reason why it is believed to be efficacious. So Eliade gives the logical explanation. For the man of the traditional and archaic societies, the models were revealed at the beginning of time, having a superhuman and transcendental origin. Well, let me try to tie this all together here. The point is that the temple knowledge is transcendental. It's supposed to teach us things that are potentially not lawful to be uttered. Neither can those things be made known, things we need to experience for ourselves. And hence, they're always under attack by the adversary in this world because they open men up to the kingdom of heaven and to the reality, the actual reality. And so he poses this question. He's like, okay, we have this temple knowledge. How did any of it survive? This is on page 385. He says, this takes us to another stretch of the road, usually designated as hermetic. How did anything happen to survive? That is the hermetic secret. We all know that what is hermetically sealed is tightly preserved from destructive influence, like the atmosphere. Against a future time when we open it up and smell the beans or the peaches or whatever. And he goes on and he talks about how some of the Mormon scripture was preserved for us, it having been hidden away and preserved in the earth. Let's just read this. While the hiding, nothing is more understandable given the conditions. For sadly, the enlightened order of things of the great days, Adam on Diamon, or Arcadia, cannot endure the normal rascality of the race. Men had spoiled it already in Adam's time. And Adam and his wife mourned before the Lord because of Cain and his brethren. He quotes Moses chapter 5. In each dispensation, the world went bad while the prophets united in futile protest, as in the days of Samuel, Hezekiah, Isaiah, and Jeremiah. In the powerful phrase of Ether, the prophets mourned and withdrew from among the people. The prophets always tended to form societies of their own for mutual comfort and security, for they usually appear in numbers in times of crisis. And in that same year, there came many prophets prophesying unto the people that they must repent. That's 1 Nephi chapter 1, verse 4. They were not well received. When not preaching, it was their custom to keep a low profile or simply to depart from the scene at the time in the time-honored manner of the Rechabites, a pattern we find repeated over and over again in the Book of Mormon and vividly depicted in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Let me repeat that again. When not preaching, it was their custom to keep a low profile or simply depart from the scene. The holy outcasts would form with their followers a community of saints, a church waiting, an ecclesia, let's call it, a congregation, waiting and working for Zion. Zion itself is a model of such a retreat from the world. And from thence went forth the saying, Zion is fled. In their retreat, the righteous refugees take particular pains to preserve the sacred records. We think of Moses, of John, of Ether, or Moroni, preserving, studying, and editing the sacred records by special command. Without that protective care, the malice and envy of the wicked, or the carelessness of the stupid, would soon distort and mock the holy books. The righteous recluse, sometimes appointed by God to survival, escaping the persecution, wars, and natural disasters, is a standard fixture of history. So this arrangement divides the world into two camps. Origen, the first and foremost of Christian theologians, divided the church itself into two bodies of members, the esoteric and the exoteric, corresponding to the two different ways of comprehending the teachings. The words are his, and they speak volumes. Both societies shared the common membership, but while the exoteric side made up the popular congregations, the esoteric community was limited to those who understood and could be trusted with the deeper meaning of the doctrine. This division between the people is not a natural one or an inevitable one, for normal human beings are capable of qualifying for either society. Men were not always carnal, sensual, and devilish. That's Moses chapter 5, 13, we are told. But only became so when they yielded to the enticings of Satan and were henceforth shut out from the presence of God. So what we can see historically is that we generally have a division between these two types of societies. And the exoteric community tends to get very dogmatic and very literalistic about the teachings. The division between the two societies, this is page 388, cultures or worlds, is truly a great and yawning gulf, much greater than we realize. And actually, the meeting between the two worlds produces a severe culture shock, if one of them really is holy. So, he's basically describing the situation throughout history and why I think that this system of rituals had to be enacted in the first place. It's so that the teachings can survive hidden in plain sight and that the mechanism is available for those who are willing to take it up, for them to transcend, for them to approach the heavens first and then enter therein, or approach the nexus, through the nexus point at least, and enter the living world, transcend or visit or see it, whatever that is, whether in the body or out of the body, I know not, right? But this is different than the typical public teachings that you get in most societies that get standardized and then changed, and then the true meaning of the gospel is lost over time. And this is demonstrated in the Bible. Also, we don't have to go very far to verify that the Lord taught in symbols and parables. He says, quoting Matthew chapter 13, Nibley just puts it right in there, that the Lord said to a small group of disciples, it's given to you to know the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven, but not to them. But to them it's not given, because they seeing see not, and hearing hear not, neither do they understand. For this people's heart is waxed gross, and their ears are dull of hearing, and their eyes they have closed, lest at any time they should see with their eyes and hear with their ears. They shut it out. Matthew chapter 23, talking of the leaders of the people, of the exoteric crowd. They shut up the gate to heaven. They will not enter therein, and they won't allow anyone else to enter either. That's me inserting that quote from Matthew. And he says that, Nibley says that the Lord here is observing and preserving the ancient order of things. His mission is directed at two separate societies, those who have heard and received the message, and those who heard but would not accept it. Well, he goes on to explain Hermeticism. He says that Hermetism is the label for a body of knowledge resembling that of the gospel, which has been circulated among mankind for a very long time. How does it relate to the gospel? That is the question I shall now attempt to answer. It was always claimed by those who accepted the Hermetic message as true that it was knowledge revealed in the beginning to one Hermes Trismegistus. He was a man who became deified only after his death. He was always identified with Thoth, the Egyptian god who presided over all branches of knowledge and the dispensing of such. He was also identified by the learned Egyptians with the famous Imhotep, the great vizier of Djoser, the founder of the third dynasty, and one of the great creative geniuses of all time. Imhotep was beyond dispute a real person, and whether he was the thrice great Hermes or not is beside the point, which is that there actually were men living in far distant times of the caliber of the fabulous Trismegistus, and the equal of any who have lived since. He goes on to put Joseph Smith in the same camp, that he was a world-class hermeticist, and Thoth is identified with the Greek Hermes, who's identified with the Roman Mercury, and they're also all identified with, or syncretus with, to use the scholarly term, they are related to in a religious sense. They have overlapping form and function and mythical stories with the Hebrew Enoch. Enoch is the messenger god. He brings the temple knowledge to mankind from the heavens. That's what Hermes does. That's why it's called Hermeticism. This is about dispensing all branches of knowledge, which we've learned in the prior chapters is the purpose of the temple. Well, Nibley goes on to say that dogs bark at anyone they don't recognize. He laments, I don't know if he laments it in this particular essay, but he has in various places said, you know, people have asked me, well, if you're so smart, why aren't you rich? And that demonstrates their lack of understanding, right? The treasures are the treasures of the heavens, not the treasures of the earth. That's not what Nibley was seeking. He was always seeking the treasures of the heavens. And therefore, the hermetic quest for temple knowledge was essentially one of the main drivers in his life. Well, Hugh Nibley goes on and discusses the Hermetic tradition throughout history and names a lot of names, from the Egyptians to the Greeks. Talks about the Orphic Pythagorean rites, Pythagoras, of course, Plato. He gets into the Middle Ages and talks about Roger Bacon, Ficino in Italy, who really brought the Greek Hermetic text to Europe, Pico della Mirandola, Robert Flood, Francis Bacon, Giordano Bruno, John Dee, Athanasius Kircher, Cagliostro, Emanuel Swedenborg, etc., etc. And then he gets into some of the most recent theosophists, when science broke the spell and a line of quacks and occultists took over. And he talks about Eliphas Levi, Madame Blavatsky, Aleister Crowley, etc. He just kind of mentions them briefly. But what this says to me is that the tradition has been kept up throughout history, even during the Great Dark Ages, the period that our LDS correlated teachings tell us where there was where there's really nothing going on. And I think this is important because when you open your mind up to the Hermetic tradition, the esoteric, you've got to be willing to look beyond the accepted canon and the accepted teachings. That's the point. That's the point of this whole essay. He talks about the relationship between the gospel and the Hermetic tradition. And at the end, he basically makes the point that neither the version of the gospel that we have nor the Hermetic tradition gives us everything we need. He says, page 426, precisely because the earth is filled with apostate or defective versions of the true order, that's the holy order, the sent ones that come to teach the truth. Joseph Smith taught that these ordinances would serve as a standard by which the subcelestial impurities of surviving remnants of earlier gospel dispensations could be judged. The employment of such keys, according to the prophet, was in certain signs and words by which false spirits and personages may be detected from true. So the point is that there is an actual reality, and that at times and places on the earth, certain men have been given information about that actual reality, and they have left us understanding in various teachings, ceremonial ritual, and practices that they instituted while they were here, and that gets corrupted. So anyway, Mormonism is not a Hermetic movement nor a descendant from any older dispensation of the church through horizontal succession. It is interesting that the terms vertical and horizontal succession are now being used by theologians to distinguish between two types of tradition, the one by revelation, the other by inheritance. A Yale professor has recently given expression to the frustration of the doctors in trying to pin down Mormonism. The exact significance of this great story, this is a quote from this guy, persistently escapes definition. One cannot even be sure if the object of our consideration is a sect, a mystery cult, a new religion, a church, a people, a nation, or an American subculture. The Mormons remain a people apart. Their inner intellectual and spiritual problems cannot be easily shared with others. To justify the title of this talk, a quotation from the Book of Mormon will make the connection. For he that diligently seeketh shall find, and the mysteries of God shall be unfolded unto them by the power of the Holy Ghost, as well in these times as in times of old, and as well in times of old as in times to come. Wherefore the course of the Lord is one eternal round. So, I asked myself this question in the notes. Is this Hermetic imitation bad? Is imitation bad? God will not be mocked. He will not accept a mockery. That's what the temple is, a template. And even in the true order, things get corrupted. We have apostasy. The vital function of the priesthood is to teach how to identify counterfeits, counterfeit teachings and counterfeit messengers. And Mormonism is not necessarily equal to Hermeticism. They are not the same thing. And neither one gets us all the way there. If we're to understand really what Nibley's inference is here in this essay, only via revelation can we obtain what we need. Now, a lot of people reading this, I think, thought, well, isn't this great? I have a church founded on revelation. Joseph Smith got revelation, and therefore I'm in the right place, and that's all I need. Well, that is the big question, isn't it? Who is it that is supposed to be at the center of all of this? Who is it that is supposed to receive the revelation? Who is it that is supposed to repeatedly converse with the Lord through the veil? I know that was kind of a shotgunning of a lot of stuff in Temple and Cosmos. There's a good book for you to read if you want to get a start on things. It's not perfectly laid out. It's not perfectly clear, in my opinion, what the big picture is, but I think you can read between the lines. And if you want to take the view, this is the incredible genius of Hugh Nibley and how he, I think, stayed safe during his career. You can take the view that when he's talking about revelation, when he's talking about priesthood, that it is what you see in the institution. You can take that. And that's the danger of the exoteric tendency towards dogmatism, is that everything becomes defined and labeled, and there are no mysteries, and there is no room for leeway. Priesthood is, quote, the power to act in the name of God, and it is priesthood keys that are passed from man to man, rather than knowledge that unlocks the mysteries of the heavens. The covenant path is to go to the temple and get the ordinances versus going there to take your bearings and recognize it as a scale model so that you can use the knowledge to have the real thing. That's the danger. And then at some point, the imitation, whether it's hermetic in its underpinnings, like a temple ceremony, or whether it's literalist and exoteric, like a gospel doctrine class or a temple prep class, the imitation then takes on a life of its own and becomes the reality for the learner, for the initiate. There's a lot to think about there. Okay, I'm going to leave it at that. I'm going to be doing one more solo podcast, and I think I'll just do it on Cosmos again. You guys have a great week. Thanks for listening.